Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeras, New Mexico, and this is a special podcast series called Colorblind. I'm speaking via phone with Herb and Donna Hall. They're Frankfurt High School alums. They're teachers and theater people. Hi, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Hey. So I want to jump right into this because we have a lot of stuff to talk about today, but I wanted just to verify. Herb, your dad was a civilian employee stationed overseas, right?
Yes, he was. He was a DOD civilian, and he worked with the Army.
Oh, okay. And Donna, was your dad military?
Yes, he was 20 years Air Force.
Okay. So the both of you graduated from the zoo, right?
Yes, we did.
Yes, in Frankfurt, yes.
I guess you're going to have to explain that. But what year was that?
It was 1968, and we graduated from the Gesellschaftshaus, which is the community center in the zoo, because it was a large, you know, place where you could do this.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I don't know how many other high school classes can graduate from the zoo, but it does have a very 60s twinge to it there too.
It does.
So what was it like going to school at Frankfurt High School in the 60s? You were far from the States, but were there racial tensions or problems between the Americans and the Germans? And I guess to follow up with that, then, how were current events handled by teachers and things like that?
Well, I had an interesting experience because I was born there.
Ah.
And so I never did the rotating and going from base to base as most of the military kids did, because as a civilian family, we could stay. And we moved several times within Germany, but we didn't have to ever go back to the States or back to the world. And I had a little different experience because, number one, German's my first language.
Mm.
And when I was a little kid, I found that Germans looked at me not as a racial entity, but it was out of interest, and because most of them hadn't ever seen a black person.
Uh-huh.
And their experience that a black person spoke German was way beyond them.
Okay.
And so I had very, very few, if any, problems with Germans racially. The vast majority of them were with the American kids.
Okay. So do you want to give some examples of what was going on?
Yeah. I can. Well, one example, which is really funny with a German, was when I was about five, my dad and I were walking down the street in Frankfurt, and a young mother was coming from the opposite direction with a kid who was about my age.
Mm-hmm.
And as he came closer to us, he saw us and he pointed at us and he said, "Mutti, Mutti, guck mal, zwei Schokoladenmänner," which means, "Mom, look, two chocolate men." And when they got right up to us, my dad looked at the little boy and he said, "Ja, aber uns kannst du nicht essen." Which means, but you can't eat us. And the lady was mortified. I mean, she grabbed her kid and she ran down the street because they had no idea we understood what they said. And it was a lesson for me, for my dad, that didn't come out of racial bias.
Right.
You know, it was just something they'd never experienced. On the other hand, when I was in the third grade, a German glass blower came to our school and did a demonstration. This was at Frankfurt Elementary School.
Okay.
And my class went through, and every class, once they watched him, was able to go up on stage and stand with him and watch him do something, and then you would file out. When I got to him, I said something to him in German.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so amazed that I spoke German that we had a little conversation. Then he said, "Hier, das ist ein Geschenk für dich." And he gave me a gift, which was a little glass-blown horse. And I went back to class, and I had it on my desk, and the teacher saw it, and she said, "Where did you get that?" And I said, "The glass-blowing man gave it to me." And she said, "No, he didn't. You stole that."
Oh.
And I said, no, he gave it to me. He says, why would he do that? And I said, because because I spoke German to him. He said, you don't speak German. She said, that's not true. I'm calling your father. And she left the room, and I was mortified because, of course, all the kids are looking at me and pointing at me, going, ooh, you're a thief, you're bad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And after lunch, my dad came to the school. He had to walk because we didn't have a car from his office, which was about a half an hour, to the school, and had a conference with his teacher. And she told him that I had lied, that I had stolen this little glass animal, and that she knew I lied because a little black kid couldn't speak German. And my father kind of set her straight and said, first of all, he speaks fluent German, and he did not lie, and he did not steal this. Oh, and what I forgot is that when the teacher first confronted me, she made me take it back to the man.
Oh.
And so by the time this was all settled, of course he was gone. I didn't have the little glass horse. But you know what? She never apologized either.
So, did she treat you differently than other kids before then or after then? Did you notice anything?
Hadn't noticed it up until then. That was the first time anything like that happened in that class.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, I mean, it's so long ago, I don't think she treated me all that much differently. I think there was maybe a little bit of deference to me that she shouldn't pick on me, but she didn't pick on kids a whole lot anyway, so
right.
That's hard to say.
Donna, did you notice anything in going to school? And well, you went to school in the States as well as Frankfurt then, right?
Yeah, I went to 25 schools in 12 years.
All right, well.
So my dad was transferred every 18 months to 2 years,
mm-hmm.
where in actuality a lot of military stays are about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I did go to States in school, school in the States. I did go to school in Tokyo, Japan, junior high, and then high school in Frankfurt.
Okay. So, you know, the 60s, of course, were turbulent, and there were, the Vietnam War and racial tensions and other things. Was there a lot of, especially in the, I'm thinking high school or even middle school, was there a lot of discussion amongst your teachers about the events back in the States or amongst the students, or were those problems acted out in your high schools like they would have been in the States or not?
It's hard to say because we didn't experience it in the States, so we weren't aware of what was going on here.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it in the, we heard it on the news,
mm-hmm.
but everything was filtered through AFN, the American Forces Network, and
right.
So we kind of got the military perspective on everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was a lot of the anti-war sentiment yet. However, Donna and I both had a contemporary problems teacher who was very open-minded. He taught us a lot about how to have a conversation when you didn't agree on a specific topic.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very clear that he was not a proponent of the Vietnam War. In my class, he had an exercise where every morning, since the news came on AFN at every hour on the hour, at the beginning of class, we had to keep every day a running tally of the body count in Vietnam. How many Americans and how many Viet Cong were killed that day? And we did this for the whole semester. And at the end of the semester, we found out that if we added up all the dead Viet Cong, that we had already wiped out their entire population of North Vietnam. So that made for an interesting discussion about, how do you manipulate numbers and where does this come from and so forth.
So I'm very intrigued with that because you're on a military base in a military school and your teacher is making you do body counts. Did any parents complain about that, or?
Not that we're aware of. And it wasn't that he was, you know, teaching from one side of the issue. We talked about everything, and there were lots of different topics. That just happened to be one of them. But it was always, the point always was, regardless of which side you're on, you have to be able to back up what you're saying with facts. That was his message. But, you know, like I said, most of the news that we got on the radio and the newspaper and so forth was very filtered through a military perspective.
All right. So did current events from the States, even though they might have been filtered through AFN, did that ever go into kitchen table conversations at home? I mean, did your cousins write you from the States and tell you what they were up to and involved in any of these things? Or were you pretty much insulated? Either of you?
We were pretty much insulated. This is my experience. I felt pretty much insulated because I didn't really correspond. When you have to move every 2 years, you make friends fast and know you got to leave. You got to leave fast. So we never kept up correspondence in those days, or late 60s, early 70s. And so they didn't write. Interestingly enough, the one cultural epiphany I had was when a friend of mine went back to the States and he wrote back and said, "Man, you got to get back here. This marijuana is everywhere." And I thought, I don't even know what he's talking about. It wasn't there. Drugs just were not as, you know, I'm sure, of course it was there, but it wasn't prevalent in our school. And I did not know what that meant. Now, in Frankfurt, Germany, with no legal drinking age, there was a lot of drinking going on, but there wasn't any drugs as far as I knew.
And in our family, it was, we didn't hear so much about it because our family's kind of spread out. We had relatives in New York, but we're not very closely knit. And since I had German relatives, because my stepmom's German, they were there in Germany. So we were getting our news, I guess, secondhand, you know, Time Magazine and those kind of reports. So we were aware of it, but we also didn't have the TV access. So we weren't seeing all the civil rights stuff firsthand on television. Everything was kind of, you know, you were getting it a day late or several days or a week later. So we knew what was going on, but the ramifications weren't the same.
And I have something to add. As you know, Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, which happened to be the town of my birth. Now, in April of 68, we were still in Germany, but I didn't want anyone to know that I was from Memphis. I was so, you know, appalled, shocked. I can't think of all the words. So I would not tell anyone. If anyone ever said, "Where were you at?" People in the military don't ask you, "Where are you from?" They ask you, "Where were you born?" And after Dr. King got killed, I just could not tell anyone I was from Memphis. I was, you know, so.
My dad just wrote a story. He was, he's writing his memoirs. He's in his 90s now.
Yeah, we met him.
Well, he was in Washington, D.C. the night after Martin Luther King was assassinated. He was on business from Germany there. And so he was there. And so he was writing his experiences and some of the rioting that happened. And it's interesting to read it from a 90-year-old's perspective, you know, what was going on. So a quick question then. So where did you guys meet? Did you meet in Frankfurt or?
Yes, we met in the Spring Musical, Once Upon a Mattress. And ironically, since we're talking about it, opening night was the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
Oh.
And that, before the performance, our director came to me and asked me if I would, if it would be okay to do a moment of silence in honor of Dr. King, and if I would lead it. And so I did that before the play started. I asked everybody, you know, for a moment of silence. Everybody did it, nothing happened, and it wasn't until afterward that I found out that there were some parents who were not very pleased that that I did this.
And some of those parents were my parents.
Your personal parents?
My personal parents railed when we got home that how dare this black kid get up and ask for a moment of silence. And, you know, they didn't know he was a friend of mine or that we liked each other at the time.
Right.
But, yeah, that's how my parental units responded to that.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
So you guys met, but did you date in high school or did you...
After that, yeah, once the musical started, we dated a little bit. You know, we would go to the snack bar together and go for walks in the park and that kind of thing. And that was through the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't live in the same town.
Uh-huh.
I was one of the bus riders. It took me 2 hours to get to school every day.
Wow.
So... And then after school, I had to get on the bus and go home for 2 hours. So seeing each other during after school was not going to happen.
Right.
We really did most of our dating once we graduated, in the week or so after we graduated.
Mm.
And then Donna's family moved back to the States a week later.
Mm.
And we moved back to the States so I could go to college in August. So we separated at that point.
So... While you only dated briefly and mostly during school, did any of your friends say anything about, you know, your being, you know, Caucasian and African American? Did that come up, or and did Donna's parents even know?
No, they did not.
Okay.
And because I knew how my father would react, and I don't think any of our friends knew at the time that we were. You know, dating. I could be wrong, but we never got, you know, I never heard of anyone saying anything.
Yeah, and my friends didn't either.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do know that when I went to the prom, I took a girl who was white, and a real good friend of mine told me that another kid who we were both very good friends with said to him one day, "Doesn't it bother you that Herb's taking a white girl to the prom?" And that really devastated me at the time because I thought this kid was one of my best friends.
Huh.
And that really hurt. But in terms of Donna, I don't think any of our friends really knew at the time. And it was such a short period of time.
Right, right. So... I want to go a little bit more into this. So when I left home, I'm like Herb. I spent my entire childhood in Germany. I was born in France, grew up in Germany. And when I graduated high school, I went to college for 2 years in Munich. But when I finally went to the States, I had an awful time adjusting to living in the States. I moved to Norfolk, Virginia in the early 80s. I saw some hints of racial equality, but I wasn't really looking at it or looking for it. So I probably missed a bigger picture out there, but I was so busy freaking out about being in the States and not feeling like I fit in. I felt like an outsider. I had a horrible time adjusting, and so I wasn't looking at a bigger picture. Did you guys have culture shock? I know, Donna, since you moved so much, it was probably just another thing. But Herb, was it a culture shock for you? And both of you answer, you know, where did you end up going to college? Adjustments, culture shock?
Well, I did have some culture shock, but I left Germany about June 15th, 1968, to go back to Memphis, Tennessee, who they were still reeling from Dr. King's assassination, which is where, of course, it happened.
Right.
I mean, there were National Guardsmen on the corners, much like we've seen here in the recent weeks. You know, businesses boarded up. We had curfews. So for me, that was just a huge bucket of water thrown into my face. I thought, what are these people doing? And but as far as going to, I went to Memphis State University from 68-72 to train to be a teacher. And as far as going to that college, which happened to be a liberal arts commuter school, no dorms, we just got, drove to school, went to classes, drove home. I didn't really have any instances where people were shocked that I had, you know, gone to so many schools. Over to Herb.
Yeah, for me, I wound up going to New Mexico State University. Sorry, all the Lobo fans.
Yeah.
But I had never lived in the United States. And so even though I knew about the States and I consider myself an American, I got a lot of culture shock. Some of it is kind of funny. Like, I had never seen a mall. I didn't know what it was. For me, if you went shopping, you went to the PX. So when I went to a mall, I didn't know which store I was supposed to go into to buy anything. I couldn't understand, you know, choose between Penny's and Macy's, this and that. I didn't get it. I didn't know where to buy sheets. I didn't know where to buy anything. I had never seen a pickup truck in my life. I had never seen a real live cowboy. I thought they were only in movies and they rode horses all the time. But I also got racial culture shock because it was the height of the civil rights movement, and there were expectations that I didn't understand. On the one hand, there were people going, well, why don't you listen to this type of music? Why do you listen to that type of music? There were most of the kids, most of the African Americans at that school were athletes. I was a theater major. And so they would get on me about, well, why don't you hang out with the brothers? Well, I go, well, why don't you hang out with the theater majors? You know, there were white people who didn't like the fact that I was around white people all the time because I was the only black kid in our theater department for 4 years. I was the only black kid in the band for 4 years. So I was torn back and forth. There were things that I was expected to do that I didn't understand. And I didn't know why I was supposed to do them, and I didn't necessarily want to do them. So there was a lot of that kind of thing for me. It was pretty difficult.
What made you come to New Mexico for college?
An accident.
Oh.
I had no idea how the going to college experience was supposed to play out. I knew I was going to go to college. That was just a given. And once I was a senior, I started looking around going, I know nothing about colleges in the United States. And a friend of mine said he wanted to go to UCLA. So I went, okay, the only thing I know about UCLA is that they have Bruins. And so I looked into that and I found out that the entrance requirements were something I couldn't meet. And then I had some other friends who said they were looking at school in Arizona and Colorado. And the only thing I had decided was I didn't want to go to school on the East Coast because I'd been to New York and I did not like the East Coast. I was not going to the South for obvious reasons. And so I figured, okay, that leaves the West somewhere. And my cousin, who was in the Air Force, happened to be stationed nearby one day. He came and said, listen, you ought to look at this school in New Mexico. I used to work at White Sands, and you might like it. And I laughed. I thought, New Mexico, it's a desert. I mean, there's nothing out there except cactus. But I had enough brains to look into it. Arizona State never responded to me. Colorado sent me a brochure that had pictures of like 10-foot snowdrifts. And New Mexico State sent me a picture of the beautiful Oregon Mountains and the sun.
There you
and
go.
And so I went to my cousin and I said, does it snow in Las Cruces? And he said, no. I went, done deal, because I am not going to be in a marching band in the snow. I've done that, and I'm never going to do it again. So that's how I wound up at New Mexico State. It turned out to be the right school, probably for the wrong reasons, but it was a great experience for me.
That's cool. So you were a theater major, and Donna, I know, was studying education, but you're also a teacher. You taught in, did both of you teach in Beverly Hills High?
No, we're both teachers. I got recruited out of New Mexico State to teach in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught there for 13 years, and then I decided to do the starving actor thing and move to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And after about a year of doing that, I fell into a job at Beverly Hills High, and then that turned into a 29-year career at Beverly Hills High teaching theater and film, among other things.
And I taught English, French, and German from 72 to 2016. But I was in the South for a while, and then I came out here. And it was, of course, a very different experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a good way to end my 45-year teaching career, being here in a very small private school, very liberal, very mm-hmm. caring and nurturing place to be. So,
you're both teachers, and teaching, of course, in the 70s and 80s gave you lots of current events to insert into your classroom discussions. Like, I'm thinking, you know, Germany's reunification. I'm thinking, some of the civil rights things that, you know, we've been discussing. How did you make your classroom discussions relevant? Because, you know, you have to teach a curriculum, but yet you want to teach real life in the same. How did you have discussions about relevant current events, and how did you decide what to talk about, and how did you manage?
Well, I taught German in 1972, and a lot of it was teaching the language and grammar, but mm-hmm. also I included the history. So for me, it wasn't as much about what was going on right then, but I tried to tie it into current events. And I would do an experiment where I had three groups of people. I'd say, okay, you're redheaded, you're disabled, and you are a person of color, go in that group. Okay, the rest of you go over here, I'll be white people. And then the rest of you go in the third group, and I'd walk around and say, okay, you guys are going to concentration camps. You guys are going to go live the high life, you know, as white Americans in the third category.
Stayed home, I think.
Yeah, stayed home. And so, no, I know what it was. I told him, what if you woke up one morning and there was a wall between our city and the next city, and your grandmother was on the other side, and you could not get to her? How would you feel?
Yeah, so the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, that's how I brought in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, that's a hard concept. I mean, you know, we don't think about that, but the Berlin Wall went up in a relatively short time.
Yeah.
And so with theater, of course, I would think it would be a little easier, Herb, to be able to, you know, put that into the curriculum, just any sort of current event.
Yeah, the thing was is that I didn't really get to do that so much until I got to Beverly Hills,
mm-hmm.
Just because of the nature of the community and, you know, what I was allowed to do. But I did shows that really brought that kind of thing out. And I would do things with the kids in the show to kind of force them to understand what it was like. For example, I directed A Piece of My Heart, which is about women in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I separated all the kids in the show by military rank, by all their designations, so the cast members who were civilians could not speak to the military, mm-hmm. the enlisted people could not fraternize with the officers and so forth while they were in the rehearsal process,
mm-hmm.
So that they would get an idea of what it was like. They were given ranks. they had to, you know, they had to learn military jargon and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
For another show that I did called No Child, which deals a lot with racial prejudice in New York, I had every kid would have to come in and give examples of when they had experienced this kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not allowed, during rehearsals, they were not allowed to hang out with any kids that were not of their ethnicity that they played in the show. So these were the kind of things that I would do so that they would learn what it was, what it felt like. Because mm-hmm. for a lot of those kids, it was culture shock also. They had no idea that that kind of thing went on.
So how did you guys then finally meet again? Because you guys obviously had been separate. Had you stayed in touch, or did you just run into each other at a reunion, or how did it happen?
Well, as I left Germany a week after graduation, and then I went to Memphis State University and Herbert, New Mexico State University, and we did keep in touch for a while. You know, we wrote letters back and forth, as you did in those days, and then eventually, you know, our lives moved on and we lost touch. And I got married and had two beautiful children, which I do not regret having. And then in 1995, I saw a message on a military online community board on AOL that said, "Does anyone know where Donna Peacher is?" And I wrote, it was like, the bulletin boards in those days were like putting a note, actually putting it on a bulletin board.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote back and said, I'm here, I live in Memphis, who is this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He made me guess for 3 days who he was, and I guess every boy in the school except for him.
Well, there. That was humbling, wasn't it, Herb?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
So we reestablished our relationship on the internet, and he would fly to my area, and then I would fly out to California. And in 2004, he said, "Why don't you just stay?" And I said, "Not without a job," because we had had too many friends that did that, reunited from high school, got together very quickly, and it just didn't work out. So that's the way we did it. And you can tell your AOL story.
Yeah, the beginning of this actually is, I was working in a scuba diving shop part-time. And one day was a slow day. These guys were having a conversation about this thing called AOL. And I go, "I don't understand what this is."
Right.
And they were explaining it to me. And I said, "You mean all those stupid little discs that I keep getting in the mail, I throw them away all the time?" And of course, they just cracked up. And they said, "Don't throw it away next time."
Uh-huh.
And so I got one. And this was in January. But I was afraid to do anything with it. And I sat on it until Memorial Day. And on Memorial Day, I finally said, "I've got to try this." And I put it in the computer, and the first thing that popped up was, "Send a message to the military." And so I did. I wrote a message thanking, you know, the military for what they had done. And all of a sudden, it popped up with all of these pages of military schools and overseas schools that you could find, the school you had gone to, and connect with it. And that's how I found Frankfurt High online, and then posted that message for Donna.
Wow. Yeah, I used to get those discs in the mail and throw them away too. I was like, "What is this?" So then you guys met up, and then you decided to get married.
We actually went on vacation into Hawaii in 2006. And we had talked about it, but we had never made any, you know, definite connections or decisions.
Mm.
And we were walking around looking, you know, at engagement rings. And we had decided that because we're both ocean freaks, that we wanted something with dolphins. And we went in store after store and found nothing we liked. We found one more store. We said, "Okay, this is the last one," and we quit.
Mm.
And we found the perfect wedding bands. But then we kind of went, "Okay, now we have these wedding bands, now what do we do?" And Donna said, "Well, we could get married here." And we were driving and we saw this car with a bumper sticker that said just Maui. And I thought it was the dumbest thing I had ever seen. I said, I would never do business with anybody who has a bumper sticker that says that. And, of course, Donna immediately called them.
Ah.
And 3 days later, we were standing on the beach in Hawaii getting married with a Hawaiian priest and then a young man that blew the
conch shell.
And it was glorious. The only thing Herb said was, well, we're not going to have a reception. There's no one here. There's no, we can't have a wedding reception. No one's here but that we know. And I said, we can have a party when we get home. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came home in October. We had a wedding reception of sorts. And he called me in the back room. He said, Donna, they all have presents. And I said, yeah, that's what you do. You give presents to newly married people, or some people do. So, yeah, that's how that kind of worked out, and it worked out great, and I'm really happy.
We still are.
I was going to say, that's a good deal, huh? You just get some cool rings and go to Hawaii, and then you get presents. I mean, what's the downside? So what did your folks say about your getting married?
Well, my folks have been dead since 2001, so they didn't say much.
And in my case, my dad was dead. My mom is still alive. Now she's 107.
Wow.
But my family in New Mexico, they love Donna. Yeah. She's their favorite. So, and my brother, the only thing my brother had to say was he was upset because we didn't invite him to the wedding. We had to tell him we didn't go to Hawaii planning this. There was no time.
Well, you know, they say good things come to those who wait, right?
That's right.
Exactly.
So, shifting gears, you know, right now we're in a pandemic. And within this pandemic, we're having public outrage about so many things. You know, people are mad because they've lost their jobs, businesses are closed, we're frightened because of this god-awful disease. Then there is outrage about police brutality, and of course there's a huge discussion about racism, and you know, people are out protesting, and then there's rioting. From your vantage point in L.A., what are you experiencing out there in L.A.?
Well, in terms of the virus, the one thing that we're noticing now, unfortunately, is that people are getting very lax, and I don't think they're taking it seriously anymore. I think they've just kind of decided that it's over.
Mm-hmm.
And you see more and more people who will not wear masks. In fact, pretty much the only time you see it now is if they're required to when they're in a store.
Mm.
They're congregating again, doing all the stuff that they used to do before there was a pandemic, as if there was a switch was turned and everything just ended.
Mm.
Which, you know, that kind of scares us. I mean, I won't go anywhere without a mask. Neither one of us does.
Mm-hmm.
And we just both decided, you know, when all the restaurants and everything open up, we're not going to be the first ones in line. That's right. Not happening.
Right. Have you seen any of the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests, or any of the rioting or looting? Or?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I was in the hospital when this started. Mm-hmm. In L.A.,
mm-hmm.
started in Beverly Hills with the looting and stealing, but I was in the hospital and completely oblivious, would not turn on the news, and then when I came out and Herb said, look at this town as we go through, it did look like, honestly, it looked like a movie. It was a ghost town, all the businesses were boarded up, sheriffs were on the corner, and our town, Van Nuys, there are still some National Guard. So I came out of the hospital and felt like I had crossed into another dimension.
Right.
But it was because no one could come see me. I didn't watch the news, and I wasn't engaged at that point. But coming out and seeing what I saw was so shocking to me. And it all kind of brought it home that, oh, yes, this is happening.
Wow.
Yeah, and I spent the first evening when I took Donna to the hospital, I sat in the waiting room for 5 to 6 hours, which was the first night of the demonstrations. And people started coming into the ER who were bloodied. And that's when I started posting on Facebook about what I was seeing, the number of people who had been shot with rubber bullets, who had been injured, and so forth. And then to see what it was, a deserted ghost town. But the one thing I have to say is I was also here during the Rodney King incident, and I, from where I lived then, I was closer to it, so I could see the buildings on fire. I could see the actual looting taking place. We're a little farther away, so we haven't seen that much of it, although we hear the sirens running up and down the streets. We see the helicopters, the gunshots. Just a couple of blocks away from us, they torched a pharmacy for God knows what reason. So it is a little surreal. I don't want to say I can't, you know, I'm not one of those people that says, oh my, I can't believe that it happened here. Yeah, I can.
Yeah.
Because there is so much outrage and so much pain. And unfortunately, I still hear people going, well, why don't they just, why isn't everybody just peaceful and behave? And my answer always is, first of all, when has there ever been a significant social change in this country that did not involve some kind of violence on one side or the other, or both? You know, and I bring up the point of, you know, the Native Americans were peaceful. How well did that work out for them? You know, Asian Americans, they behaved. They did what they were supposed to. World War II, they wound up, the Japanese wound up, you know, in camps. Yeah, I was trying to think of the one that's just close to us up north.
Manzanar.
The civil rights movement, you know, it just keeps going on and on. So I say, I don't condone the violence and the, you know, the destruction and that kind of thing, but hopefully enough people this time will get the message that you have to do something, not just let it disappear and then it goes away and you quit service.
And I have, my perspective on that is that at first I thought, oh, this won't last long, and then it'll go back to, you know, the old, old world, and they'll just think, well, nothing can be done. But we did live through the civil rights movement, and these young people don't realize that the protesting and the, you know, all of the things that we did, it took a while, but it made a difference. But for instance, you know, before, when I first got home, Herb couldn't come see me in Memphis in 1968 because of his father, who was black, and his mother, who was German, got caught on the bus, they'd be arrested.
Wow.
It wasn't until 1969 that Memphis finally said that a biracial couple could marry or interracial. So that's my perspective on that.
So do you guys feel safe going out there in LA? I mean, do you do your daily, whatever you, I mean, without, pandemic aside, but if you want to go to some place, do you feel safe, or is it like dangerous right now with all the volatility?
No, I feel safe. I think we both do. We it kind of depends on where you're going, number one. It's kind of died down a bit. A lot of the real unrest has been in downtown, in the downtown area, and then, you know, that area around Beverly Hills that first night. But I don't have a problem with going somewhere. In fact, I probably worry more if I have to go to the store and worry about people who won't wear a mask.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. because I can't control that.
Yeah, well, and that's a volatile situation too. It seems that people have died trying to uphold masks laws. So this is a very volatile time for so many reasons. People across the nation are having real conversations now. I know that radio stations are going to be playing Sam Cooke's song, Things Are Going to Change, or Change is Going to Come. On Tuesday, even here in Edgewood, which is a tiny little town in New Mexico, high school students got together and had a Black Lives Matter peaceful demonstration the other day. And it's everywhere. The conversations are happening everywhere. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think people who haven't gone out and protested or who, don't know what to do, they want to do something useful, but they don't know what to do. What do you think, what kind of thoughts do you have? And then also, can one person really make a difference in affecting change? I mean, they always talk about one person, be the person who makes change happen,
Yeah. I absolutely believe that one person can make a change if it starts filtering through, their groups and then outside of their groups.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't leave the house at this time due to my illness, and I would be putting myself at risk for the COVID virus, I have found a platform online that is not normal social media. It's called Slack.com. I get no money for saying this name. But you can set up groups.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my way. What I have decided I can do at home online is get to groups, not to my group of friends that are politically minded, same-minded.
Mm.
And I know they'll vote, and I know who they'll vote for, but I'm trying to reach groups of people that are on the fence or, why bother voting? It doesn't count. That's my contribution because I can't leave the house.
Right.
I can do that every day online, and nothing may come of it, but I feel like I can try to make some things happen. And maybe if I change one person's mind about voting, that it'll be worth it.
As far as I'm concerned, I think one person can make a difference in the same regard. What I'm thinking is it helps if people who have experience will challenge people who don't. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people will blow it off. Whenever something comes up like this, they say, oh, well, it's not really that bad. Oh, come on, you're just making stuff up. Mm-hmm. I've never seen it. And they're very dismissive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that just breeds more anger, resentment, and pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when people go, wait a minute, I'm going to challenge that belief system, that helps a little bit if you can get through to a person like that and let them see that, no, it is a big deal. It isn't a contest about which group has suffered more, or when somebody turns into a yes, but.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep after them and you have to keep reminding them. Unfortunately, I think the Floyd issue is so volatile because so many people have seen on video what actually happened. And in my mind, it's the same as the pictures that came out in the civil rights movement when on TV people finally saw the canines attacking black people and the police officers and fire departments blasting them with high-pressure fire hoses. That's what it took before people actually got the message that, yes, these horrible things are being done. But we didn't have the video in those days. We didn't have social media. So it took longer. Now we have it instantaneously.
Uh-huh.
And if you're not afraid to be a little confrontive, you can get through to people. There are always going to be those who don't get it. And it's frustrating. I mean, there are times when Donna and I both go, we're not looking at Facebook, we're not looking at anything today because it hurts too much.
All right.
You know, right now I just can't do it. I'll do it again tomorrow or something.
Mm. Yeah. Donna, I wanted to ask you, when we were thinking about making, you know, people, turning people's opinions around or, you know, changing their mindset, did you have a story about your dad?
I did have a story about my dad when he was stationed in Labrador.
Is that Canada?
Pardon?
Is Labrador Canada?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
And if, you know, to answer, can one person make a change? He was in charge of the NCO club.
Mm-hmm.
Walked in one day and the white soldiers were building a fence across the club. And he said, what are you doing? And they said, well, the black guys aren't coming over here. And he said, you take that fence down, and by the time I turn around three times, it better be gone, and we'll not hear any more about this. So, you know, that one person, that one incident made a change. And ultimately, according to my father, all of the soldiers became one group, you know, came together mm-hmm. at the NCO club. So.
What year was that, roughly?
That was probably 1959, late 1959.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an amazing story. I mean, first of all, the fact that they're building a physical fence in the building is mind-boggling. But that your father would not condone that is really good. And he enforced it, and then people actually had to talk and mingle and find out about each other, communicate.
Exactly, because this is, imagine Quonset huts in, you know, Labrador, which is northern Canada,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't go outside and, you know, play ball. So these guys came together, apparently. Not that there weren't still, you know, attitudes of racism, but they could sit down together and have a beer.
Mm-hmm. So we probably should be wrapping this up, but did you guys have any other thoughts or things you wanted to talk about regarding racism, being brats, culture, military culture, anything?
The only thing I would add is that there's often been a mindset that there is no racism in the military, that it's completely colorblind.
Uh-huh.
And I would have to say that's not the case.
Mm.
There, because it's the military, once the military was integrated, yes, by law, they had to treat everyone the same. There were certain rules that everybody had to abide by
mm-hmm.
because they were in uniform. But that didn't mean it changed the people's behaviors personally.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean it changed their attitudes. It just meant that they changed what they had to do, for example, when they were at work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would often hear people say, well, I never saw anything racial happen. Well, that's because their fathers weren't allowed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was underhanded.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have experiences with that kind of thing. Not always from adults, mm-hmm. sometimes from kids. If I can give you one other example, in Germany, you know what Fasching is?
Yeah, yeah.
A Fasching season. When I was in the fifth grade, I was in Cub Scouts, and they decided to have a costume contest with all the Cub Scouts.
Mm.
And I was devastated because I thought, I don't know how this is going to work. My dad was divorced. At the time, he hadn't remarried yet, and I had always been raised by a series of housekeepers,
mm.
and we had a very, very young German housekeeper, and I went to her, and I told her what was going on, because I knew my dad wasn't going to buy me an outfit for this contest, and she said she would make me a costume.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And I thought this was cool. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know what she was going to make. And then one day she came and says, okay, I want you to try this on. And she pulled out this thing. It was a clown suit that she had made out of crepe paper. Mm-hmm. And half of it was orange, half of it was yellow. It had a little hat with the little balls on it and covers mm-hmm. for my shoes. Mm-hmm. And I was mortified because I thought it was ugly. Mm-hmm. And I think she could tell, but she said, just try it, just try it. She put it on me. She made some adjustments, and it was really the coolest thing ever. So when this costume contest happened, she went with me. Mm-hmm. And they put us all up on stage, and it became very clear very quickly that there were only three of us who were in contest, you know, consideration. And so they started eliminating all the boys. Finally, the last three of us were standing up there. It was myself, a boy who was dressed up in his mom's dress, and another kid, and I don't remember what he had on. And we waited and we waited and they deliberated because the scoutmasters were doing the voting. And finally they said, okay, we've made a decision. And the little boy who was dressed up as his mom won. Mm-hmm. And there was this moment of kind of weird silence and then some polite applause, because even the audience kind of went, that's kind of weird. But I, you know, we were done. I shook the kid's hand. I went off the stage. And I was standing next to my housekeeper when one of the scoutmasters came over to me. And he said, listen, I think you should know this, but all of the scoutmasters agreed that you had the best contest. But, you had the best costume. But they didn't think it was proper for a Negro boy to win.
Oh, dear.
And then he walked away. And I was, like I said, I was in the fifth grade. And I couldn't hide my emotions. I just kind of looked at my housekeeper, and she looked at me, and she could see something was wrong, but she didn't speak English.
So she didn't know.
She didn't understand it.
No.
And so she just said, was hat er gesagt? What did he say? And all of a sudden, I had to try to explain to this woman, who was 21, I think, that the reason her costume didn't win the contest was because I was a Negro.
Wow.
And I explained it as best as I could, as, you know, whatever age I was, 10 or 11. And she couldn't conceive of what had just happened. But that wasn't, you know, that's the kind of thing that went on that other people wouldn't know.
And I have one example, one last example of coming back to the States, 1968, having not seen my grandparents for 20 years. And I, you know, we lived with them for a while. And my grandfather, who was a sharecropper in Mississippi, you know, back in the day, would use the N-word. And I finally told him, I said, Papa, that's not appropriate. It's not what is used. You know, if you want to say, at that time, African-American, maybe even Afro-American, that's okay. But I said, I will not stay in a house where that word is used. And he never said it again.
Yeah. Well, so again, one person can make a difference.
Yes, absolutely.
So there's hope. So I was going to say, you know, these kids trying to make their way today, the ones that are just graduating or, you know, being, you know, finding themselves in this weird COVID situation, what message would you give to these young kids today that are, I find this world incredibly hard? What kind of hope, messages of hope?
Well, I will say that I talked to my son-in-law recently, and he's 30. And he said, Donna, I think this is our generation's civil rights battle. And I said, Justin, I agree with you. You young people, you know, have to keep the message going, and you have to keep having conversations, because I went through the, you know, prelude to the Civil Rights Act being voted in, and I saw the change. When I got to Memphis in 68, black people could not sit at the counter in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
After the Civil Rights Movement for however many years, you know, suddenly things had changed.
Mm-hmm.
Concrete things had changed. And so I told them, don't give up. Don't, you know, ever give up. You can make a difference, but you have to keep the conversation going.
Right.
And I would tell them the same thing. You have to keep the pressure on. You can't just go, oh, it's been a little while now, well, it'll kind of fade away, because then if it's not in the public eye, people mm-hmm. forget about it and nothing gets done.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons I say that's why this violence is happening, because people are sick of being polite, being peaceful, and then having nothing change whatsoever. And the other part I would say is that you don't have to buy into, give it some time. One of the things when I was growing up was always being told, well, you can't get all your rights so quickly. Black people shouldn't be pushing so hard. It takes time. People have to get used to it. And I always say, no, it doesn't. Mm. The people who have the rights didn't have to take time to get used to it.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm.
So I would tell people, keep the pressure on constantly. It's hard. And it's especially hard for people who aren't, you know, who don't live with it on a daily basis.
Right.
Because it's easy to forget. But if you put yourself in the shoes of the ones who do, and you witness what they're going through now, then you can't afford to get tired. You just have to keep doing it. Sometimes you feel like you're beating your head against the wall, but you just do it until the wall breaks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that's a good message for everyone who wants to be helpful and who is standing by, ready to run towards this somehow. But we do need to wrap up. This has been over an hour. It's been a great hour of conversation and stories. Yeah. And so I wanted to say once again that this has been Circe Wessner and Herb and Donna. We're all talking on our new podcast called Colorblind. Stay tuned for more episodes in the next few weeks on our Podbean site. The museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, New Mexico Humanities Council, and the Sandia Area Credit Union. And I wanted to thank you very much for joining us on this warm, sunny afternoon. Donna and Herb, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Circe.